This is a Cyber Union talk show for Monday, October 24th, 2011. Union busting scumbag bastards.
Hello and welcome to Cyber Unions. I'm Walton in Glasgow, Scotland.
And I am Stephen, still in occupied Boston.
Stephen, how is occupied Boston?
It is going quite well, and a lot has actually been happening the last couple of weeks. I think I mentioned last week that I was on the IT Tech Working Group.
That's right.
Well, there's good news. Previously, they had been using the Google Groups and Gmail for the Occupy Boston Logistics Working Group and Media Working Group and everything else. And there was a proposal within the working group for us to move over to something that is more secure and a group that would defend us in court if anybody tried to come after the names. And so they decided to go with mayfirst.org if you ever want to check that out. So it's really cool. So we have email set up. And even the server for the Occupy Boston is being done from May 1st. They actually gave a server directly for Occupy movements. And so it's pretty cool. They've made the switch over. It was put to a General Assembly proposal, and it passed the proposal. And some good questions came up from it. People wanted to know the transition, what the interface was going to look like, and how it would be different. And what they actually asked to have a day or two to look at it first before deciding, and that's what actually happened.
Excellent.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. So that's been going along. And with it, the Occupy Boston, we have a chat room on the IRC, on Indie Media's IRC channel called none other than hashtag Occupy Boston. And I've been on there as an op to kind of manage it because it's been getting slammed with a tremendous amount of spam and trolls and people coming in there being complete idiots. And just adding stuff that doesn't even make any sense, being proud of being part of the 1%. And we're like, great. You know, they said, go get a job. I'm like, all right, are you hiring? So been kind of managing that a bit, which has been a bit of a pain in the neck because sometimes people get pissed when you kick or ban somebody because they're like, oh, I thought this was about free speech. I'm like, well, yes, but they're not adding to the discussion. They're trying to derail any discussion here. But anyhow, so that was a bit of a activity that I've been trying to keep up on with the tech working group as well. So other than that, I guess there's been other stuff going on too. I'm learning a lot of stuff, and that's kind of the culture with this IT working group. Is there are a lot of people that are into free and open source, which is great, and they are asking people if you want to take on some responsibilities, and you don't know anything about it. There's gonna be training, and we're so they're developing like classes on how to do IRC to how to manage a server, which is what I'm learning on, and I just learned about GPG keys and still don't know what SSH completely does outside of but I'm learning, which is the cool part on that. So there's a lot to go over. And this coming weekend, we have a pretty cool, actually, this will be already done by the time this gets aired. Noam Chomsky is going to be speaking at Occupy Boston, which will be really cool to see. So I'm hoping to go to that and be able to report back on that next week. But other than that, how is things going in Glasgow?
Well, we have an Occupy Glasgow as well. There's occupations in a number of UK cities, and there were occupations in Glasgow, Dundee, and Edinburgh. I think only Edinburgh and Glasgow in Scotland are still occupied. The occupations are small, and the occupiers look very cold. The weather has been pretty miserable. It's been consistently raining and cold and wet. But they, went to spend a bit of time with them, and they've certainly dug themselves in for the long haul. They're occupying George Square, which is a square in the center of Glasgow, which has some real occupation history, because in 1919 there was almost a revolution in Scotland. This was obviously during the time of the massive uprisings after World War One, when there'd been obviously the Russian Revolution and attempts at a revolution in Germany. And there was one in Glasgow as well, and people massed in George Square, and the British Army sent in tanks. And probably if they hadn't sent in tanks to put down that revolution, history might have been quite different. But it was it's a historic rallying place for people in Glasgow who are fighting power. So A good place for an occupation. And I guess all I would say is that if you are in a city that is occupied, go down to the occupation, even if you're not sure how you feel about it, because some people, you know, have mixed feelings about occupation, because it's a different kind of politics. It's not standard protest. People are there for all sorts of different reasons. But go down to the occupation, speak to the occupiers, and get a sense for yourself of what you think of what's going on. We found everyone there. I went down in a suit, you know, because I was working. But there were people were friendly and told me what they were up to, and they were very inclusive and very welcoming, and it was a good atmosphere. So go down to your occupation, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. That's one thing I've been trying to encourage people, especially people who have made some like blanket statements about, oh, a bunch of hippies and all this other stuff. I'm like, well, go down there. See what it's like. See what they're trying to do. Don't make your judgments from the sidelines. Go and actually see it and then make your decisions. If you think the same way,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, so be it. But at least you went there.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, or, there's been a lot of people saying, you know, it's too this or it's too that. And, you know, for goodness sake, if it's too, you know, some people are saying it's too hippie. Some people are saying it's too white and middle class. Some people, you know, it's quite contradictory as well what people say about it. If it's too one thing, go and join it and then it'll be more like you, you know. It's kind of a simple argument to that. The other thing I've been doing is we spoke a couple of shows ago about Paranoid Linux, which was mentioned in Cory Doctorow's book Little Brother.
Yeah.
And how cool it would be if there was an actual Paranoid Linux. And you pointed me in the direction of the Amnesiac Incognito Live System, or Tails, which is it's a live version of Linux that runs off a USB. So I've actually been using that basically just as a test, and it's pretty cool. It runs off a USB. You plug it in, and you can boot up any computer, you know, in an internet cafe or your own computer or any computer that you like. And it runs off the USB using only the computer's RAM. It doesn't touch the computer's hard drive unless you specifically instruct it to do that. And basically, it boots into Debian, and it's got Tor configured, and it's got a whole bunch of other privacy stuff on it. And essentially, it gives you a very high degree of security. Not total security, because nothing ever does. But, you know, if you ever need to do activist stuff that you don't want to be monitored, you can actually run this system. Probably good for journalists, whistleblowers, people like that. Mm-hmm. And you can pretty much do everything you want. And it's easy enough to use. I didn't have any hassle. Plugged it in, recognized my wireless and everything perfectly, straight online using Tor. You're able to create documents and save them on the USB in the home folder. So it worked pretty smoothly, and I was impressed with it. I think it's a useful tool for people who are concerned about surveillance.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. That's really cool to see that you finally tried it out, which is great, because I know you're a little bit more hesitant to distro hop than I am.
Yeah.
So, but no, that's cool. That's cool. Anything else been going on over there with the... in the world of the UK and the Euros?
Well, the big thing I've been involved in is the union I work for, Unite, is going through a recognition campaign with a company called GE Caledonian, which is General Electric. And it's a GE Caledonian site in Prestwick on the west coast of Scotland. Mm-hmm. The reason it's interesting is because a while ago we noticed that the union busters had started visiting our site, and they wrote a piece about how the idea of unions using swarm organizing was enough to give them sleepless nights, which I found very encouraging. GE Caledonian have been doing a lot of union busting stuff. Basically, it's a big company in the aerospace sector. They make airplane engines and components for airplane engines. They're next to a big airport. And we tried to unionize it in 2004. And in 2004, the company hired a company called the Burke Group, who did quite heavy-handed intimidatory stuff to try and get people not to join the union, and the recognition bid failed, and we were kind of barred from going back for a few years. We're back in there trying to organize it. The campaign's going pretty well. I think 60% of the people in the workplace have actually signed up as members. There's a, you know, clear desire for among people to join the union. At this time, the company's being a lot more subtle, and they've hired a law firm called Eversheds, which a lot of employers use. Mm-hmm. And I was just looking on the Eversheds website, and they say they have 65 years US experience with union organizations provides valuable parallels from which UK employers can learn how to stay union free. So it's clear from US experience that worthy UK employers who are imaginative, nimble and flexible will be able to defeat union organizing efforts. So the Eversheds approach is basically to tie everything up in legal knots and make it really slow and intractable so that our members there can't see the woods for the trees. And I think they hope that we'll become despondent and the organizing tactic would fail.
Let's hope so that you guys defeat them.
Yeah. So, you know, I figured now is the time for us to have a proper discussion about union busters. And
I think that'd be great.
You know, I'll give you a bit more background to what's happening in this particular site. General Electric, GE, is in the aerospace sector, which is one of the last sectors in Scotland that still does heavy manufacturing with kind of high skill, high value added, high wage jobs. Uh-huh. It's the kind of thing that made Scotland's industrial revolution. It was always kind of highly skilled, heavy manufacturing, and a lot of those jobs have gone. But these are the kind of the sort of few places that are left in the industrial heartlands of the west of Scotland. And it's exactly the kind of jobs that a country like Scotland needs. And GE's competitors are companies like BAE Systems and Rolls-Royce. Mm-hmm. Very heavily unionized by our union, very well organized. I've worked quite extensively with stewards in those sites, and they're excellent. And they practice really good and really proactive industrial relations. And despite being heavily unionized, both BAE Systems and Rolls-Royce don't have a problem being competitive, you know. So mm-hmm. I don't understand what GE's problem is, like why they're spending so much money, and it's a fortune, union busters charge a fortune, why they spend so much money on trying to bust unions, because the unions in places like Rolls-Royce keep the company on the toes, but I think in the long run they do things which actually benefit the company. I mean, certainly what we do in there is we negotiate on skill levels to ensure that the employees keep training people and keep skill levels high. We negotiate for them to take on more apprentices and for them to make agency workers full time. It's all sorts of things that protect jobs, but in the long run actually end up investing in sustainability of that business. And that's not a popular model among business people. They want to be lean and flexible and skip off to countries going to lure them there with cheap tax breaks next. But, we don't think that's a good way of doing business. And we want people to invest long term in our communities and neighborhoods. And that's why the unions are in there.
Yeah.
So anyway, it strikes me that, and this is not to kind of try and lay the blame at your feet or anything, but it strikes me that a lot of this union busting stuff comes from the US. So can you please take it back? or can you at least give us some insights into where it all comes from and what it's all about?
Well, if anything, it is a growing industry. unfortunately, not the type of industry that I want to see growing. What was interesting is because we had that article that they tried to do that whole, worried about swarms and everything when we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, just that they were looking at that, mm-hmm. linking to our show or to our site for that matter. And I went and looked at the organization. What was the name of it again? I actually forgot. It was like Labor Relations Inc. or something like that. And I went through and just kind of looked through their site just to see what they had. And it was really interesting because I actually listened and watched some of their videos on their staff people. And a lot of mm-hmm. them are former members or workers in places that were unionized, and they had criticisms of the way the union was working. And they, some of them became leaders, became presidents, and apparently couldn't bring about the change that they had hoped for. And instead of actually trying to change the unions from within, they opt to let's try to get rid of unions because then, life would be so much better. And that just is such a stab in the back of being in the labor movement as well as, like, trying to actually affect change. And so it's not surprising to me because it's happened a number of times. In fact, when I was in grad school studying labor studies, a former alum from our
program, which is really the most pro-labor program you could ever find, that nobody there was ever for corporations, and if they were, they never stayed through the program, who became the lead negotiator for the university against our graduate union. It's just disturbing when you start seeing people who saw the light and then they use it for their own personal gain because they can make more money that way.
Yeah, go over to the dark side of the force because of...
Yeah,
because of money. It is disturbing. You see that everywhere, I think.
Yeah, and when you were telling me about Evershed before, I was thinking about one of the big companies here in the States that actually does this is another law firm called Jackson Lewis. And they are notorious. Mm-hmm. They kind of do subtle things. They will give tips on how to find out if union organizing is happening and how to fight off a union. And their tactics are very... They're really screwed up because they take advantage of the laws, like you were saying with in England. Like that stuff's been happening in the States for a long time. And one of the reasons that a company will pay so much money for it is one, they keep that flexibility. But even though it's costing them so much money in the short run, it gets them more money in two different ways. Mm-hmm. One, Wall Street will give them more money because Wall Street doesn't want a union in most cases. And secondly, by keeping wages down, they don't have to pay higher rates and then they can move their factories wherever. If anything, that's what we saw in the States back in the really starting in the late 60s to 70s of and into the 80s of factories being moved. And GE was one of the big companies that did it. So
all right,
they moved factories in Western Mass. And some of these factories were organized by some of the more radical unions, too, like the United Electrical Workers had shops in Western Mass that represented a tremendous amount of factory workers. And they saw it. They knew what was happening before GE started proposing these things and tried to fight it, but they just couldn't gain enough pressure on the companies, both from the public and politicians and everybody else, to actually prevent GE from doing this. And now that GE gets away with like polluting, having had polluted the land and never having to pay fines for it, it's one of the favorite song or chants that we always hear around here is union busting is disgusting, and it's because it does happen a lot, and their strategies vary. And you probably will see this is they'll do, at least in the States, there are certain rights that you're supposed to have. And I'm going to put a link in the show notes of what is actually supposed to be posted in any workplace, no matter what, of informing you of what your rights are at work, what you can do to form a union and what your employer can't do. Some of the terms are vague and the unions will take advantage of it. They will break the laws because they'll get more, they'll be willing to pay the fines than have a union, that's what ends up happening. And our National Labor Relations Board, which enforces these laws, can get caught up in court systems exactly the same way like you're describing. So these are things that have been happening for decades here in the States. It's really disturbing what levels they'll take it to, even to the bargaining tables. The managers will hire Jackson Lewis lawyers to do the bargaining. So you're not sitting in front of your management. You're sitting in front of somebody who's hired to be doing the negotiations with your contract. And some of the things that they fight with, something that you guys don't have to worry about as much in the UK and most of Europe, is one of the key things that we negotiate here is healthcare, because we don't have a universal healthcare system. And that becomes a huge, huge thing. Like the Verizon workers that are still negotiating with Verizon, one of the big things they're trying to get the workers to do is pay more of the healthcare costs instead of Verizon paying for it. And they'll do closed door sessions at work. They'll have everybody in one room and they'll be talking to them about how, you know, we're about teamwork, we're a family, you know, we don't want a union to come in here to intervene between us and you. We want our relationship to grow and all this bullshit. They look at it and they try to play this card that the union is a third party and the workers are not part of it. And when I think of it and when you look at it, the workers are organizing themselves to have a union. Whether an organizer from a union is coming in there to inform and educate them on their rights and what they're able to do, it's still their actions at the end of the day. It's not the union coming in saying, this is how you're supposed to do it. It's the workers saying, this is how you're supposed to do it. The employers do a lot of crazy shit, and they'll get away with it because they know that they can fight the legal system and that the workers aren't going to have the same financial resources.
Yeah, they got deep pockets, haven't they?
Oh, very deep pockets. I mean, especially when it comes to this. I mean, companies put money aside just to fight off unions. I mean, if we're talking about, you know, economic efficiencies and everything that capitalism speaks of, this is not efficient. This is actually preventing efficiencies from occurring, because we know that unionized workplaces work more effectively per hour than any non-unionized workplace. And you get more, you get better work out of the workers than you do in a non-union workplace. And, but, you know, the strategies are really, really crazy out there. And part of it is taking advantage of the process. And I don't know what it is in the UK, but in the States, the standard process for getting a union is you have an election. And to get an election, you have to have 30% of the workforce sign a card saying that they want a union election, and then an election can happen 6 weeks after that. In that 6 week window is when Jackson Lewis and all these companies will come in, and that's when they start doing one-on-one meetings. They'll do intimidation factors, and they'll do whatever they can to split the workers against each other and force them to fight. So like in certain industries, they'll do things specific, like in the hotel and industry. Especially with like housekeeping, hotels will notoriously hire people that are a tremendous amount of them who are from Asian countries, and a tremendous amount of them that are from South and Latin America and Central America, because they know that this, they don't always get along, and that they'll get their own little groups and they'll never unify. And they take advantage of that opportunity to try to force a union never occurring. And then what people don't also think about is companies think about the stuff well in advance. Like big companies think out how their workplaces are designed to prevent people from the workers from discussing at work or being able to be friends at work and talk about things. Do you see that in the UK as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they're in fact, you know, once again, to lay the blame entirely at your feet, what I think happens is that a lot of management strategy and HR practice starts in the US, and then some, you know, there are plenty of business people in the UK who admire the US for its lean business model and all that kind of stuff. Someone in the UK starts importing that thing, and then we see the same kind of organizational design develop here. And, you know, something for a whole other show is the development of soft HR in white collar workplaces, where essentially peer groups monitor each other rather than like having sort of direct HR human resources bosses monitoring you. And there's all this, you know, all sorts of stuff which frankly unions just don't have the resources to counter and develop counter strategies to. But one of the things that you know I've been thinking of is the kind of arguments that they use, you know, the anti-union things. And you know, the big one is the fact that the biggest one that they use is the fact that the union is not there to represent you. The union is a business, and they're there to represent themselves. And, you know, they want to make money off the card check. And look how rich these trade unionists are. They're all in cars and stuff like that. but also, you know, things like collective bargaining doesn't really work, because, they always say, we don't have to accept the deal that's negotiated. You might end up with a worse deal. And then they go and say strikes, you know, what will happen is the union will bargain, we'll refuse, you'll have to strike, and the union will force you to strike. And, you know, strikes do happen, but certainly the big companies that I was referring to, I don't know when there was ever a strike there, you know, because good industrial relations practice is that you actually, you know, it's an achievement to avoid a strike. You actually come to a deal that both parties can work with. You know, and then there's always the thing, like, if you get a union, the jobs will go, and workplace relations, you know, we're such a lovely, cozy, happy family, all that kind of thing. If you get a union in here, it's going to introduce antagonism. So there's all these kinds of things, but you come to expect them. But I've seen some really weird ones. And one of the weirdest ones I saw was in the past, working conditions were so bad and we needed unions. But now they're better, so we don't need unions anymore, because we have enlightened employers who can look after your interests. You know, and just like who dreams up these tactics, I don't know, but it's just ludicrous.
I mean, the thing is, it's effective in a lot of ways, and I mean, I can't speak for entire industries, but I could talk about like one of the experiences I had that. When I worked, I was there for like almost 2 years working at Monster.com. They have their headquarters is outside of Boston. And when I was there, I didn't know anything about unions. I had no clue. But all I started to realize when I was there is, like, these working conditions suck. Like, I can't – my phone cord, because I answered phone calls, was not long enough that I could actually talk to my coworker that was right around the corner. Like, it was literally short enough that I couldn't actually get over there without taking it off. And to take it off, I had to go on break. So it was really controlled in that sense. And our lunch breaks
– battery chicken.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Our lunch breaks were staggered. So none of us were ever – if we're on the same shift, we never had the same lunch break. So it, like, my coworker and I worked from noon to 8:30 at night, and he and I never had the chance to actually talk except after work, and that was it. But the design of it was really crazy. And when I was there, I was just getting so fed up with it. I did not like the work that I was doing. I felt like it could have been done in a better way. And so I started, like, researching and, like, you know, workplace. I Googled workplace complaint, nothing getting resolved. And lo and behold, I came up to a union website. And I just started reading about it. Now, my manager, who I worked with there, was a friend of mine from college. And he actually, if anything, probably got me the job there. Not that I, you know, was, like, all thankful for him. But, like, one day he and I, this is when I smoked cigarettes, and I don't advocate smoking cigarettes anymore. But he and I were coming back from a smoke break. And as we're coming back, I was like, hey, Ben, You know, I've complained about this and to you, and I heard that so-and-so complained about the same thing, and nothing seems to be getting done. And my next word was, I think we could work better if we had a union. And he literally turned to me, and I kid you not, he looked at me and said, if you try to bring in a union here, I'll do whatever the fuck I can to get rid of you. And serious face, like, he'd never taken this tone with me before. Like, I'd gone to hockey games with him to watch them, and the big fans and everything, always shooting the shit, never had any confrontation. And from that day on, he became big brother. And the first thing he started doing was making sure, he was watching over my shoulder all the time, making sure that I was doing my work, making sure that I didn't have, like, a downtime. And it became really unmanageable to the point where he drove me to quit, and that's what I did. And it's just the management, and that's where you think about it. Management's job in this case is two things. One, to make sure a union doesn't come in there. And secondly, to get the most out of you in a given hour to make more money for them. And this is just across the board. And even at Monster.com, which had a huge tech sector, even those departments were structured differently to make sure that they didn't have the same abilities to communicate. And I kind of developed this culture of, like, it's all about me and not about all of us. And
absolutely,
and we see that a lot in a lot of sectors, and it's disturbing the way they do it, because they start developing a workplace culture that's different from what we actually want. And not to say that we all want this collective feeling, but it seems more natural to have that instead of, like,
For me, it's one of the most natural things in the world to get to know the people that you work next to. You know, you might not even like them, this is something that goes back to the beginning of time. People have always worked, and you've always worked with people, and some of them you like and some you don't like, and some you don't think do a particularly good job, and others you know, but you talk to them, and that's how you pass your day. You have conversations, and in fact, in a lot of cultures you sing songs, you know, and there's a lot of culture that actually comes from the time that people spend working. And that's, you know, that's been taken away from us, because when you talk to people, you get to know them, and it builds solidarity and a sense of being part of a collective. And you know, that's not what this model of management wants from you.
Yeah,
because you're easier to control as an individual.
Yeah, and that's the other thing too. Individually, the other thing that people don't really realize, especially in the States, I don't know again the laws in the UK and everywhere else thoroughly, but if you go and complain to your manager on your own, you have no protection in the States. They could, like, in most states, you're a right to work state, which means that you can be hired, you can quit for no reason, and you can be fired for no reason. And just complaining to your boss could lead to being fired, and you'd have no legal recourse. But if you go in there with a coworker and informing your coworker what you're complaining about, then your rights get kicked in, so they can't retaliate against you in that situation, because you came as a collective. And as a collective, you have more power and you have more rights. And when you have a union, even if it's the worst freaking union in the world, that's corrupt and all can be, you have more rights in that workplace by having that union. And you can try to change that union. They're small democracies. You can try to change that democracy to be more reflective of its community. And people like the organization that reviewed our stuff look at it and say, oh, my way of solving the problem is let's get rid of unions and forget about your rights. That's not going to help us. And it's disturbing when that happens. And they go the short way instead of the productive and constructive way of developing these democracies. And I mean, which is inspiring to me right now because Occupy is developing democracies right on the ground. But in the workplaces, it's a whole different situation. One of the things that people claim in the public here is the Bill of Rights that exists in our Constitution. What they don't realize is that your Bill of Rights does not exist in the workplace. You do not have the freedom of speech. You do not have the freedom to assemble. You don't have the freedom to complain or grieve for anything like that. They can retaliate against you for doing that. And they'll set up an intimidation that makes it seem like they're doing you a favor when legally they should be, you know, actually advocating for you instead of against you. Anyhow,
I mean, it's a corporate dictatorship, isn't it?
Yes.
One of the things I was thinking today is how, you know, a lot of people like the Occupy movement are loosely social democratic. You know, if you had to describe their politics, it's probably social democracy, but a lot of them are also not keen on big state solutions.
Yeah.
But, you know, the perfect way around that, strong trade unions. If you have strong trade unions, you don't need a big state because people get paid properly. And, you know, there are all sorts of other things that the unions start doing, which takes over some of the role that a really big, really powerful centralized state does. And there's just so many good reasons for having strong trade unions in society. It's a basic check on the power of corporations, and we've seen how destructive that power is. And it democratizes the world of work, which is, after all, what we spend far too much time doing.
Yeah. Actually, you kind of reminded me of one little book that I just wanted to put out there that's by, I think it's Michael Albert, called Participatory Economics, or Perry Econ. I'm not advocate for everything in that book, but it does do a good description of describing a workplace without a boss and how decisions could be made. And I think it's a good example of what we could be doing, kind of going off of last week's show on cooperatives, worker-run cooperatives, and that there are other ways that we can think about this instead of having to deal with management and bosses, and that all management and bosses are is just a layer of work that's wasted because they're not producing anything. And in a cooperative, you're more responsible to each other because, you know, if you don't do your job, you know, you're not going to produce anything, and then you can't do anything. So anyhow, I just want to throw that in there. Is there anything else you want to touch on those union busting scumbags?
No, I think that'll do.
Fair enough.
That'll do.
I think we have a bit of feedback to go over this week, so you want to jump into that?
Help will come whenever it's needed. Cheer, my comrades, cheer.
Great. So I've been kind of on the IRC back and forth a bit, not as consistently as I'd like to be, but I got into a discussion with somebody on there who's from California, and was wondering, he asked me about a number of books on labor history and the labor movement, and I was trying to scrabble to find all my books because I have too many to share and trying to figure out which ones to go with. And it's actually kind of his suggestion, as well as something that we've touched on before, which is we're going to try to put a section together on the website with books that we recommend, both for understanding the labor movement, both globally. We're going to try to look for books specifically to different countries that people are listening from. Obviously, the U.S., the U.K., and South Africa will be the easier ones that we're going to get off right off the bat, but there are a number of other ones that we'll be able to get to as well. So that was really cool to have that conversation. That discussions in there have been getting a little bit more interesting as it's grown. So, again, I want to invite people to come to our IRC, and we'll put another link on the show notes as well for it, too. There's a good way to get in touch with us and also for you guys to all talk to each other as well, which is more important, too. So the other one was something I think came through the UK, if you wanted to jump on this one.
MJ Ray, who's a regular listener, just listeners who don't know how this works is we record our audio on both sides, and then Stephen mixes it together to create the final show. MJ Ray believes that there is a US conspiracy to undermine the hard work being done in the UK. He believes that Stephen's audio is slightly louder than mine, and I've been kind of tuned down so that the US voice dominates. So I've addressed this with Stephen, and we can assure you that it will not happen in future. We will maintain perfect parity of audio levels to ensure that there's no dominance.
Yeah. I'll try my best. I figure the American voice should be louder, right? No. That if anything, I think our first shows you may have been louder in comparison, because I think your microphone recorded louder than mine did.
Uh-huh.
So the adjustments, I've made some adjustments the last couple of shows to meet that, and hopefully I'll do the same with this one as well. So the other thing was just kind of a cool bump that we got was OccupyTechnology.org, which is a website that's working with a lot of the Occupy movements in the States and globally now too, had asked for us to put a link to our show on there. And we've done that, and it's been pretty cool to see that there are some people that are listening there. So we welcome the new listeners from there as well. And hope to see that resource as it is for anybody who wants to join up to make suggestions. There's a good kind of free and open source feeling amongst a lot of people on there, but it's not entirely that. But it's another good place to see our show going to. So happy to see that. Other than that, did you have anything else you wanted to go over this week, Walton?
No, just to encourage people once again to engage with the Occupy movement.
Yes, come visit your local occupation. It's always a good thing to do. With that, solidarity with the occupations and the workers of the world, and see you all next week.
Goodbye.